The Gurus of How To. Join me now, Al and Larry Ubell, also known as Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. They visit us regularly to talk about home repair matters and to take your calls. Our number is 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And I want to throw out a personal problem. Even the slightest amount of smoke has my smoke detector yelling, fire, fire. And then I turn on the vent. I usually forget to do that when I'm frying something. But there's not much smoke around at this moment. And then I push the button to stop it, and then 10 seconds later it's back on to the point where I just want to throw it out the window.
That's not an uncommon problem. There are two types of smoke detectors out there. There are ionization smoke detectors and photoelectric smoke detectors. Unfortunately, the ionization ones are the cheaper ones. When you go into the store and you look at the prices, they're about anywhere between $5 and $10 difference.
Well, I inherited this smoke detector.
Right. And the problem also is, on the numerous studies, that they find that the ionization smoke detectors fail 55% of the time. Now, if you owned any other piece of equipment, regardless of if it was safety equipment, you would throw it away. If your phone only worked failed 55% of the time, you'd throw it back at the person you bought it from, your car, anything. But here you have a life-saving piece of equipment, and the way you find out it doesn't work is after you already have had a fire or people have died. And there are many stories where people have had working smoke detectors, batteries working, and there's been fires and people have died. And then the fire marshal or the fire examiner goes and checks the smoke detector, and it beeps. So what's going on? There's a new law in New York where they want to make people use photoelectric technology. And that's just one that's slightly more. And the photoelectric technology has a failure rate of about 4%.
Now, at this time of year, we keep everything closed, the windows closed, the doors closed, and try to seal up our houses as much as possible. Does that have any impact?
It doesn't really have much of an impact. The thing about the nuisance alerts, which is what you're talking about, is very common among ionization smoke detectors, because the ionization smoke detectors are good for two types of fires. Fast flame fires, which usually happen in kitchens, which you don't really need protection from that because you're there cooking. You're the smoke detector. Or the other thing, which is burnt toast. It's really good at
burnt. I was going to say burnt toast.
Burnt toast is it's really good at, which is utterly ridiculous. On the other hand, the photoelectric ones are great for smoldering fires. Now, smoldering fires, majority, 60 to 70% of all deaths are from smoldering fires. And they're also really good with synthetic materials. Ionizations are terrible with synthetic materials. So the other issue is now they're making, the smoke detector companies trying to cover themselves. They're making dual ones. Well, the problem is if you put a dual smoke detector, ionization and photoelectric, you'll still get the same nuisance alert. You'll still take the battery out, and it's still useless. So we at my company endorse the single type photoelectric only. My house has only photoelectric, and if you want a heat monitor or a fire detector, put in a separate fire detector, which senses heat, not smoke. And in New York State, they actually have a new law called Evianna's Law, which is going through the Assembly and the Senate in New York State, which gives you a tax credit for buying photoelectric technology. And obviously from the name, some small child named Aviana passed away.
And does it look like the other one?
It looks just like it. And lately I've been very conscious. When I'm doing my home inspections, especially in rental properties, always you see the smoke detector is open and there's no battery or it's gone completely. Interesting thing. 96% of the country has smoke detectors. The numbers that are actually operating are probably two-thirds less than that. So, actually, on our website, there's a link which tells you the pros and cons. There's an article by the American Society of Home Inspectors, and it gives you a lot of information. But you if you care about yourself and your family, get the photoelectric technology.
Yeah, and that notice on our website is in the upper left-hand corner, and it's accuratebuilding.com.
And you have all sorts of interesting information on your website.
Yes.
We have tons of
lots
stuff.
Lots of tips and how to do things and how to rewire your
home. The most popular is the scalding hot water chart. That gets thousands of hits all the time. I mean, it's amazing how many people want to know about scalding hot water. And I'm very
And what are
I'm
you
delighted.
Telling them about scalding hot water?
Well, it's the hot water that anything above 160 degrees is really a killer. It you get scalded in about a half a second. A half a second. You already have blisters on your hand or something like
and
that.
And that's worse than accidentally touching a frying pan?
Yes, it actually is because the water covers everything. It just covers your hands or covers whatever. I had a friend back many years who spilt a pot of boiling water on his feet. He had to be hospitalized. Now, if he just dropped a hot frying pan on his foot, he would have had a broken foot and they would have sent him home and he would have had one small burn.
Or if you touch even an iron, a hot iron, which is really almost 1,000 degrees, You only burn your little finger or something like that. You get
and
a
you
blister.
Can pull your hand away quickly. And you pull the water, you have to wait for the bead to use it, for the energy, the heat energy to come out of the water before it stops burning you.
Now, all the calls coming in pretty much are about heating, obviously, because of this time of year. And I want to get to as many of them as I can. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, you always bring along a quiz. And which one of you is going to read the quiz?
Well, it's
Marvin. Since I wrote it, he can read it.
Yeah. Well, actually, the writing of it is an office involvement in order to get
– You have to consult everybody at the office.
Well, because we want to know whether it makes sense to them, and we sort of try it out on everybody. But this is an interesting thing because this device goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, and it started – it really helped along in the Industrial Revolution.
Don't give away too many clues.
No, okay. Well,
he can't stop talking.
Name the machine part that enables a power shaft to rotate multiple drive shafts simultaneously, clockwise and counterclockwise, including ones that are perpendicular to the drive shaft. This part can be found in many types of mechanical equipment, such as a car's rear end differential, garage door openings, and egg beaters. In fact, the little hand drills that people have that turn around uses that technology. That hand drill is called a hurdy-gurdy.
So if you think you know the answer, give us a call at 212-433-9692, and we have a prize awaiting you if you come up with the correct answer. 212-433-9692. Don't write us with the information because we have to put you on the air, and we have to find out. You know, and later if you win, we have to
get your name and address.
Your name and address. Okay, so the number is 212-433-9692. A lot of calls coming in. Let's go right to the first call. It is from, is it Nila?
Yes, Nila.
From Yonkers. Hi, you're on the air.
What's up?
Yes. I have a shower that over a period of 12 years has been fixed three or four times, and then we gave up. The water comes, it is hot, it goes cold, it goes, and it's very difficult to control.
Let me ask you a quick question. Is it one valve or two valves?
One.
It's one single valve?
Yes.
And sometimes it's hot, and sometimes it keeps going back and forth. How old is this valve?
The year 2000, it was installed.
Relatively new.
Because I have a valve in my house that's like 25, 26 years old now, and it still operates like the day. It may need to be, there is actually a thermostatic pressure balancing mechanism inside that valve. Have they rebuilt the valve?
Well, we have changed. It's a cooler shower, and the company sent a special man. They changed the kit. They sent the kit, and they replaced it. And then again, after a number of months, and again, and finally we gave up.
Now let me ask you one other question.
So you're not taking showers anymore, Nila?
I won't tell.
Okay. I have one more question before you hop in. Do you have this same problem anywhere else in the building?
No, there is another shower right next to that one. Mm-hmm. That's your answer. Mm-hmm. Another shower never had any problem. It's a different brand.
Well, what I would recommend personally is maybe you'll get a licensed plumber that will take a look at the feed mechanism into there.
When you mean mechanism, use simple words.
The feed fittings that go in from the wall into that particular thermostatically controlled valve. And there may be some dirt or garbage coming in from that system. There may be a mixing of galvanic action where you have iron and brass mixed together. And that causes problems with these very sensitive
but
devices.
The one thing I want to recommend that maybe hasn't been looked into, did they hook up the valve properly? Is the hot connected to...
The thing is that I am now replacing that whole shower, which has the whole system. And my fear is that I'm going to replace it and it's going to happen all over again.
Let me just say.
The plumbers tell me so many things that are wrong.
Right, and that's really confusing also. I have to say that the valve that I bought all those years ago was from American Standard, and it seemed to have worked very well. But the one thing you have to confirm before they put the valve in is that the hot is connected to the hot and the cold is connected to the cold. If it's reverse, the valve is going to act very unusual, and I found that quite often. And so that thing must be – and don't just trust the plumbers. Prove to me that there's hot water coming out of this. And so, you know, make sure that's right and make sure they put the valve in right. And I think maybe that'll be the problem.
Neil, thank you for calling us.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Richard now from Brooklyn. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
What's up?
Hi. I have a landlord who shuts the heat off at 11 o'clock at night and turns it on at 4 in the morning, no matter what the outside weather is.
Let me ask you a question. What does the inside temperature get down to?
It gets down to pretty low.
Give me a number.
I don't know.
What you need to do is buy a thermometer, put it on the wall, and then when next time he does it, check the temperature when it's freezing, because if it's below, they can't go below.
You can't go below 60 degrees. I mean,
but you can't go below 65. I
65
think.
Degrees.
Yeah, you can't.
That's
go
the
below,
law.
Yeah,
yeah. 65 is in New York City, but outside it's a little lower.
Well, actually, see what it says on the thing. If it's below 60, by all means, that's not right. Take a picture of the thermometer. Go to your landlord and say, if you don't stop doing this, I'm going to go to the city and file a complaint.
Yeah, you go to HPD.
Well, if he's in the city, HPD.
HPD, the health department. There are a lot of agencies that are involved in not giving sufficient amount of heat.
Okay, Richard.
I lost.
Okay, our next caller is Bob from the Bronx. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Hey, good morning. Good afternoon.
Yes.
What's up?
We're on the air.
I wanted to ask these gentlemen, who, by the way, I enjoy listening to all the time. I purchased new windows. I had my windows replaced in my condo not too long ago, and I don't know if it's the exceedingly cold weather, but I find a lot of condensation on the inside of my windows where every morning I got to take out newspaper and, you know, dry it off, and just it is very, very wet. Is that normal, or did the person do it wrong? And I really love going to your webpage. I would like to add it to my webpage. I have one called City Island Images, which is images.me, and I'd like to add your page if it's okay.
Well, let's solve your problem. This is the window that you have. Is this an apartment house?
It's a condo.
Oh, it's a condo. So is the window frame, is it made out of metal, or is it made out of wood, or is it made out of vinyl?
The window or the frame?
Frame. What is the frame made out of that holds the glass in place?
Is it
aluminum? What?
Aluminum.
It's aluminum. Well, does it have two pieces of glass or one piece of glass?
Two
pieces of glass. Then there is something problem. There's one thing. They may have bought inexpensive windows that don't have a thermo break in the metal connection. Therefore, what happened is there's heat loss through the metal to the glass, and that condensation is condensing the moisture that's inside the room that you have there. It also could be that you don't have good ventilation in the bathroom when you take a shower, and you're dumping a lot of moisture into the atmosphere, and that's also causing condensation. It is also where the radiators in your house are positioned next to the window or under the window. All of this has a factor on whether you will have condensation on the glass.
Okay, Bob.
I do want to say one other thing, is that because now the windows are more tightly sealed, there's more moisture being trapped inside your unit. Before, when the windows were leaking a bit, you were kind of losing a lot of it. So that could be one of the reasons also. I also want to do a follow-up on the call before that about the minimum temperatures. We were incorrect. Minimum temperature during the day is 68. Minimum temperature at night between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. is 55 degrees interior temperature. So they have to maintain 55. So if that gentleman gets it,
where below it's going, 55,
if it's getting a 54, then he needs to call HPD.
Okay.
Very good.
And we have a number of people calling in who think they know the answer to the quiz, which I'm going to read this time. Mm-hmm. Name the machine part that enables a power shaft to rotate multiple drive shafts simultaneously, clockwise, counterclockwise, and including ones that are perpendicular. This part can be found in many types of mechanical equipment, such as cars, rear differential, garage door openers, and egg beaters. And we go to Bob from Brooklyn. What do you think it is, Bob?
I think it's a gear.
Well, that's a bit vague.
Gears come in all kinds of.
It could be a Richard gear.
It could be every time a gear. There is flat gears, straight gears, tooth gears. This is a specific, ingenious part that dates back several hundred years.
Okay, let's go to Mitch. No, I'm sorry, Glenn. Hi, Glenn. You're
Hi,
on
Glenn.
The air.
What's up?
Hey, hello, how are you?
Good.
What do you think it is, Glenn?
How about a screw gear?
No, a screw gear kind of in it helps with this kind of thing, but not what we're looking for here.
No, the screw gear is really good for what they call parallel connection to another gear that works that way, but we're not looking for something that does it that could turn
and there are no screw gears in differentials.
Yeah, right. And that could turn one shaft clockwise and one counterclockwise.
Okay, our next caller is Rick from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
What do you think, Rick?
I think it's a planetary.
No. I know what you're thinking, but no. But thanks for playing.
Okay. We're going to try another one. This is Howard from Cedarhurst. Hi, Howard.
Hi, Howard.
How you doing? A bevel gear.
And also, there's an alternative name. Do you know the alternative name?
I'm sorry, I don't.
It's called a miter gear.
A miter gear?
Yeah.
And the gears are at a 45-degree angle or so.
Right. How did you know this?
I'm familiar with car parts. I used to fix things myself. Mm-hmm. I used to look through bells, one of those car books, and I remember things. And I'm an engineer by training also.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Well, I'm going to put you on hold, and you'll give my producer your name and address, and what does Howard get?
He gets a copy of Recipes for Homeowners.
No, he does not.
The Al Ubell Energy Saving Guide for Homeowners by Al Ubell and George Merlis.
Okay, Howard. Thanks for calling.
Take care.
Thank you.
And we're going to go to a little break and come back with more from the gurus of how to, Al and Larry Ubell. Stay with us. And we're back with the gurus of how to, Al and Larry Ubell. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And Amelia from Crown Heights has written on our show page, I rent an older building, I have no control over the heat. My radiators don't have any controls or valves. And they get so hot that I have been opening windows in 20-degree weather. Is there a better way to temper an out-of-control radiator? Can I safely enclose it to block the head? I'm on the top floor, and more than enough heat radiates up from the lower floors.
Yes, you can. enclose that radiator. You could put a box around it, like a radiator enclosure. You could put insulation inside, like fiberglass or something like that.
And that'll cut down on the
heat? Well, you have to understand how heat travels. It either travels by way of radiation or convection or conduction. And the idea is if you stifle all those three conditions of radiation, conduction, and convection, you will reduce the amount of output of heat energy into your space.
Now, I wanted to say one thing about as far as limiting the amount of heat coming out. Most people don't, unless you're going to actually enclose this fiberglass so you don't have fiberglass fibers floating around your apartment, A way to do it easily is with towels or blankets over a radiator. It doesn't get that hot that it will cause a fire. Many people do not know if they have baseboard radiators. Those baseboard radiators actually have louvers on them, and they can open and close them to stifle the amount of heat or stuff some towels at the bottom of them to stop them from doing. And the same thing with a cast iron radiator. Just drape a towel or blanket or something over it, and that will stifle some of the heat. And unfortunately, in many pre-war buildings, you have to open the window. Actually, when I'm at my ASHI conventions, the joke is, what's a New York City thermostat? A window.
Mm. Yeah. It is interesting that the other guy had the heat turned off, and this woman has too much heat.
Yeah, but
you can't win.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I'll tell you, anybody's listening, if you have a steam radiator, don't try to regulate it with the valve on the turning valve, because that'll only cause banging in the pipes. It'll also cause water to squirt out of your radiator. You'll have water on the floor. So you got to be very careful about steam radiators on how you want to control the output of those radiators.
But if you are fortunate to have a two-pipe steam radiator system, and the way you can tell that is you have one valve coming in at the top and one goes out on the opposite side at the bottom, and there's a little nut-looking trap at the bottom called a steam trap. Those you can actually throttle up and down without problems.
Paul from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hey, Leonard?
Yes, yeah. Paul.
What's up?
Hi, Al. Larry, love your show.
Thank you.
I live in Manhattan, and I have an old-style building with the pipes that go into the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And they renovated the apartment above me last year, so every winter when the pipes are on, there's a little ring of separation between the ceiling and the pipe, and I get this rain of dust every time I come home.
Not uncommon, even in buildings where there hasn't been a renovation going on. Two things you can do. One is you can buy what they call an escutcheon plate.
And what's it called?
An escutcheon plate. Don't ask me to spell. I'm horrible at spelling. But an escutcheon plate. And what it does is it fits around the pipe. It has a hinge on it, so you can open it and then put it and push it up to the top. You have to measure the diameter of the pipe, and then you buy the escutcheon plate to match. That's the first thing you need to do. But before you install it, buy yourself some silicone caulk. Clean the area above where the dust is coming out, and clean it with alcohol, let it dry, and then squeeze in a bead of caulk in between the pipe and the plaster or drywall, and that will stifle the dirt from falling down.
Okay.
And it won't melt with the pipe getting hot?
No, because silicone caulk is actually designed for engine blocks and for installing exhaust systems, which get up to the thousands of degrees. We're only talking here about 220 to 230 degrees. Okay?
Okay, great. Thank you.
Dan from New Brunswick, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. This has nothing to do with heat, but I have a patio. It's a nice large patio.
Uh-huh.
It was built in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that there's a flagstone inset to it, and there are also a lot of cracks around it. What I would like to know is, can I pave over it? I have enough clearance so that I can there's enough clearance there so that I can get out the doors and there's
what do you want to pave it with?
Pavers, concrete pavers.
Oh, you mean just put pavers over what you already have?
Over the concrete, correct.
If you do a good sand base before you put the pavers on, if you have enough room and you fill the sand in, you probably do a pretty good job, especially if there's not a lot of settlement or deviation of your existing patio. Then if you do a nice sand base, then you could set those new pavers in, and it shouldn't be a
well,
problem.
Well, if that's a dry set, but if you want to do a wet set with a skim layer of cement, you should put in turkey wire or chicken wire into that cement in order to stifle the reoccurrence of the cracking that he has down below. Because cracking will tell me that something is happening with the building. That building is even
not
moving.
Building. It's a patio.
Or the patio is moving or has moved or something like that.
Well, happens when water from a downspout or something just drains there and causes erosion at that particular point. You also want to avoid having your downspouts drain onto your patio.
Thank you for calling. Liz in Brooklyn Heights asks, there's construction going on in my neighborhood, and every day my apartment building shakes. Is that safe? Who can I call about it? My building is a multifamily, five-story, 150-year-old building in Brooklyn Heights.
Well, the vibration of the building depends upon how severe it is and whether the cracks are showing up or the foundation is compromised by this vibration. It is really that's happening all over the city where there is construction on an adjacent lot or property. The thing is that the owner of that property should photographically document that building to see if there's any cracks in it now, and if more cracks develop over time, then he has an action against the contractor of that who is
making
that noise.
But is a little bit of vibration a cause of serious concern?
It depends upon how the building was built. If it's a steel building, it'll shake a little bit and there will be cracking. If it's a concrete building you have cracking, then there could be problems. But it depends upon the bricks could loosen up, the ties to the building that tie the brick to the building could be compromised. It depends upon how old that building is, whether the ties are corroded and deteriorated.
How does she know this?
But what I was going to say, she doesn't. And what I would do is if this is a co-op or a condo, what I would recommend to her and to her neighbors is to photograph the insides of their apartments now. Okay, the vibration has occurred. Photograph, especially on the side that's closest to the construction. And that way, at least you have a documentation. And then when there's an action, you have it. If it's a rental property, it's really your landlord's concern, and you should give him a heads up about that. If he doesn't care, then it's really not your problem. It's his problem.
Until they
evacuate you and you have to move somewhere else.
Yeah,
I wonder if there would be a lawsuit for him being neglectful of things he should have done, but I probably not.
But the funny thing about it is they don't give the violation to the person who creates a condition. They give the violation to the person who has a condition. And people get very annoyed at that. They say, well, why am I getting a violation even though they're destroying my building? He says, well, you got to fix your building, and then you have an action against that person. It's very complicated.
David from Riverdale. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to know. I live in a 1960s era apartment building, and I guess because of the cheap construction, there are issues of drainage, and we've not allowed for sink, garbage disposals, and for washing machines.
Right.
Presumably it's because of the volume. Mm-hmm. Has the technology improved enough?
Well, let me ask you a question. How old is this building?
1960s, about 50 years old.
You know, I have to say that with my own, I have a garbage disposal in my home, and I have to say that with the issues that I've had, because of the one problem with garbage disposals is that if your pipes are over a certain age, they do tend to block up because any little burr inside the pipe or anything that hangs up, everything gets caught on that.
That why they've been illegal in New York?
Well, they're legal now.
They're legal.
They've actually been legal for about 20 years now. And the reason the reason they've done that is the sanitation department is trying to transfer the cost of moving that stuff to the city plants by the piping system. And yes, once it's out of your building, now I must also confess that I've replaced the pipe going from my kitchen sink to my main sewer riser three times already because it's blocked up. Now, mine is exposed in the basement. It's not a big tragedy. But if this is inside a wall, it is a big tragedy. So as far as the technology improving, no, it hasn't that much. It basically grinds it up, and it turns it into the slurry. And if it's too fibrous, it gets caught on things. So unless that pipe coming from your kitchen, which would be 3 inches in diameter, which is really not the protocol for kitchen sinks. Protocols for kitchen sinks call for a 2-inch pipe. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's actually wide enough. So as far as the washing machines, I'm not totally sold on your organization not wanting to do it, because that's basically just soapy water. And the only problem you would have with that is oversudsing. And if you install everything properly, and it shouldn't be a problem, the only problem is down on the first floor, or if there's a basement apartment, they may get some sudsing down at that level.
That's a big problem. The biggest thing that causes blockage, believe it or not, is the corn silk. You know, people who have...
We're back at the garbage disposal, right?
Yeah, back to the bottom. okay. Thank you. The garbage disposal. The corn silk really does that, because that seems to slip right through, sometimes doesn't get ground up, and gets caught on everything
also
that's inside.
I find that the shells from lobsters and clams, for some reason, becomes very fibrous once you start grinding it up. You wouldn't think so, but it does.
We have very little time, but I wanted to sneak Catherine from Brooklyn on the air. Hi.
Hi, Catherine. Catherine?
Catherine.
What's up?
Hi.
Make it quick.
Yes, I have a thermostat problem.
Yeah.
Okay, I set my thermostat between 5 a.m. and 10 a.m. to 75.
Mm-hmm.
From 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. to 70, and then from 5 p.m. to 10:45 to 75. What I'm seeing that's happening is that the front of the house is not working correctly. I'll get heat on the second floor, but don't get heat on the third floor or the fourth floor. Mm-hmm. If I get heat on the third floor, I don't get heat on the second floor.
But let me ask you a question. Where's the thermostat?
It's by the front door.
On the first floor or the second floor?
On the first floor.
Okay, and does that room get nice and warm?
It doesn't. It's drafty.
But I mean, but what does the temperature on the thermostat say when the other rooms aren't warm?
You know, that's a good question.
Let me just say what I'd recommend you to do. You may want to relocate the thermostat to the third or fourth floor, probably the third floor, and not near an exterior door and certainly not on an exterior wall. You want it in a room where someone lives, like a bedroom or a living room or something like that. That's really important. I moved my thermostat to my bedroom because I didn't want to run downstairs at night to reset it.
Yeah, and every time she opens the front door, somebody opens the front door, that thermostat is getting thrown off.
Thermostat thinks it's cold air coming into the building. The idea is the thermostat should be located in one of the largest rooms of the house.
Now, we have gotten a lot of really interesting calls, and unfortunately we couldn't get to many of them. So people can try to contact
they
you?
They can make an attempt. The attempt
they
is...
They can make an attempt.
The attempt would be...
He is so true.
I get so busy and overwhelmed. I'm sorry. And so anyway, you could email me. Best way to email me is LarryUbell@gmail.com. Really include your telephone number.
UBELL.
Right. That's the way I've been spelling it. and include your telephone number.
Because then you can call them and you can have a conversation.
Right.
And you're going to be back, did you know this, on April 9th?
April 9th.
No, I didn't.
Well, April 9th. What's going to happen on April 9th?
April 9th,
what will you be doing?
We're going to go forth and fix, save energy, money, and
do it safely.